content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. And today we will do part two of a very long article that I read the first half of last week. It's entitled American Civilization, and it was written by Ralph Waldo Emerson, and it is from the April 1862 issue of The Atlantic magazine. All our arts aim to win this vantage. We cannot bring the heavenly powers to us, but if we only choose our jobs in directions in which they travel, they will undertake them with the greatest pleasure. It is the preemptory rule with them that they never go out of the road. We are dapper little busybodies, and we run this way and that way serviceably. But they swerve never from the foreordained paths, neither the sun nor the moon, nor a bubble of air, nor a mote of dust. And as our handiworks borrow the elements, so do all our social and political action leans on principles. To accomplish anything excellent, the will must work for Catholic and universal ends. A puny creature walled in on every side, as Donne wrote, unless above himself he can erect himself, how poor a thing is man. But when his will leans on a principle, when he is the vehicle of ideas, he borrows from their omnipotence. Gibraltar may be strong, but ideas are impregnable and bestow on the hero their invincibility. It was a great instruction, said the saint in Cromwell's war, that the best courages are but beams of the Almighty. Hitch your wagon to a star. Let us not fag in paltry works which serve our pot and bag alone. Let us not lie and steal. No God will help. We shall find all their teams going the other way. Charles's Wain, Great Bear, Orion, Leo, Hercules, every God will leave us. Work rather for those interests which the divinities honor and promote. Justice, love, freedom, knowledge, utility. If we can thus ride in Olympian chariots by putting our works in the path of the celestial circuits, we can harness also evil agents, the powers of darkness, and force them to serve against their wills the ends of wisdom and virtue. Thus a wise government puts fines and penalties on pleasant vices. What a benefit it would be the American government, now in an hour of extreme need, render to itself and to every city, village, and hamlet in the states, if it would tax whiskey and rum almost to the point of prohibition. Was it Bonaparte who said that he found vices at very good patriots? He got 5 millions for the love of brandy, and he should be glad to know which of the virtues would pay him as much. Tobacco and opium have broad backs, and will cheerfully carry the load of armies, if you choose to make them pay high for such joy as they give and such harm as they do. These are traits and measures and modes, and the true test of civilization is not the census, not the size of cities, nor the crops, no, but the kind of man the country turns out. I see the vast advantages of this country, spanning the breadth of the temperate zone. I see the immense material prosperity, towns on towns, states on streets built by the confluence of workmen and wealth of all nations, though stretching out toward Philadelphia until they touch it, and northward until they touch New Haven, Hartford, Springfield, Worcester, and Boston. And not these that make the real estimation. But when I look over the constellation of cities which animate and illustrate the land, and see how little the government has to do with their daily life, how self-helped and self-directed all families are, knots of men in purely natural societies, societies of trade, of kindred blood, of habitual hospitality, house and house, man acting on man by weight of opinion, of longer or better directed industry, the refining influence of women, the invitation which experience and permanent causes opened to youth and labor, when I see how much each virtuous and gifted person, whom all men consider lives affectionately, with scores of excellent people, who are not known far from home, and perhaps with great reason, reckons these people his superiors in virtue, and the symmetry and force of their qualities, I see what cubic values America has, and in these a better certificate of civilization than great cities or enormous wealth. In strictness, the vital refinements are of moral and intellectual steps. The appearance of the Hebrew Moses, of the Indian Buddha, in Greece, of the seven wise masters, of the acute and right upright Socrates, and the Stoic Zeno, in Judea, the advent of Jesus, and in modern Christendom, of the realist Huss, Savonarola, and Luther, are causal facts which come to forward races to new convictions and elevate the rule of life. In the presence of these agencies, it is frivolous to insist on the invention of printing or gunpowder, of steam power or gas light, percussion caps or rubber shoes, which are toys thrown off from the security, freedom, and exhilaration which a healthy morality creates in society. These arts add a comfort and smoothness to house and street life, but a purer morality, which kindles genius, civilizes civilization, casts backwards all that we feel sacred into the profane, as the flame of oil throws a shadow when shined upon by the flame of the Buddha light. Not the less popular measures of progress will ever be the arts and the laws. But if there is a country which cannot stand any one of these tests, a country whereby knowledge cannot be diffused without perils of mob law and statute law, where speech is not free, where the post office is violated, mailbags opened, and letters tampered with, where public debts and private debts outside of the state are repudiated, where liberty is attacked in the primary institution of their social life, where the position of the white woman is injuriously affected by the outlawry of the black woman, where the arts such as they have are all imported, having no indigenous life, where the laborer is not secured in the earnings of his own hands, where suffrage is not free or equal, that country is, in all these respects, not civil, but barbarous, and no advantages of soil, climate, or coast can resist these suicidal mischiefs. Morality is essential, and all the incidents of morality, as justice to the subject and personal liberty. Montesquieu says, countries are well cultured, not as they are fertile, but as they are free. And the remark holds not less, but more true of the culture of men than of the tillage of land. And the highest proof of civility is that the whole public action of the state is directed on securing the greatest good of the greatest number. Our southern states have introduced confusion into the moral sentiments of their people by reversing this rule in theory and practice and denying a man's right to his labor. The distinction and end of a soundly constituted man is his labor. Use is inscribed on all his faculties. Use is the end to which he exists. As the tree exists for its fruit, so a man for his work. A fruitless plant, an idle animal, is not found in the universe. They are all toiling, however secretly or slowly, in the province assigned to them, and to use in the economy of the world. A higher and more complex organizations to higher and more Catholic service, and man seems to play a certain part that tells on the general face of the planet, as if dressing the globe for happier races of his own kind, or, as we sometimes fancy, for beings of superior organization. But thus use, labor, of each for all is the health and virtue of all beings. Ik den, I serve, is truly a royal motto. And it is the mark of nobleness to volunteer the lowest service, the greatest spirit only attaining to humility. Nay, God is God because he is the servant of all. Well, now here comes the conspiracy of slavery. They call it an institution. I call it a destitution. The stealing of men and setting them to work, stealing their labor, and the thief sitting idle himself. And for two or three ages it has lasted, and has yielded a certain quantity of rice, cotton, and sugar. And standing on this doleful experience, these people have endeavored to reverse the natural sentiments of mankind, and to pronounce labor disgraceful, and the well-being of a man to consist in eating the fruit of other men's labor. Labor, a man coins himself into his labor, turns this day his strength, his thought, his affection into some product which remains as the visible sign of his power. And to protect that, to secure that to him, to secure his past self to his future self, is the object of all government. There is no interest, in any country so imperative as that of labor. It covers all, and constitutions and governments exist for that, to protect and ensure it to the laborer. All honest men are daily striving to earn their bread by their industry. And who is this who tosses his empty head at this blessing in disguise, the constitution of human nature, and calls labor vile, and insults the faithful workman at his daily toil? I see for such madness no hellebore, for such calamity no solution but servile war, and the Africanization of the country that permits it. At this moment in America, the aspects of political society absorb attention. In every house, from Canada to the Gulf, the children ask the serious father, "What is the news of the war today? And when will there be better times?" The boys have no new clothes, no gifts, no journeys. The girls must go without new bonnets. Boys and girls find their education, this year, less liberal and complete. All the little hopes that there hereforto made the year pleasant are deferred. The state of the country fills us with anxiety and stern duties. We have attempted to hold together two states of civilization, a higher state where labor and the tenure of land and the right of suffrage are democratical, and a lower state in which the old military tenure of prisoners or slaves and of power and land in a few hands makes an oligarchy. We have attempted to hold these two states of society under one law, but the rude and early state of society does not work well for the latter, nay, works badly, and has poisoned politics, public morals, and social intercourse in the Republic, now for many years. The Times put this question, why cannot the best civilization be extended over the whole country, since the disorder of the less civilized portion menaces the existence of the country? Is this secular progress we have described, this evolution of man to the highest powers, only to give him sensibility and not to bring duties with it? Is he not to make his knowledge practical, to stand and to withstand? Is not civilization heroic also? Is it not for action? Has it not a will? There are periods, said Niebuhr, when something much better than happiness and security of life is attainable. We live in a new and exceptional age. America is another word for opportunity. Our whole history appears like a last effort of the divine providence in behalf of the human race, and a literal slavish following of precedents, as by a justice of the peace, is not for those who at this hour lead the destinies of this people. The evil you contend with has taken alarming proportions, and you still content yourself with parrying the blows it aims, but, as if enchanted, abstain from striking at the cause. If the American people hesitate, it is not for want of warning or advices. The Telegraph has been swift enough to announce our disasters. The journals have not suppressed the extent of the calamity. Neither was there any want of argument or of experience. If the war brought any surprise to the North, it was not the fault of sentinels on the watchtowers, who had furnished full details of the designs, the muster, and the means of the enemy. Neither was anything concealed of the theory or practice of slavery. To what purpose make more big books of these statistics? There are already mountains of facts, if anyone wants them. But people do not want them. They bring their opinions into the world. If they have a comatose tendency in the brain, they are pro-slavery while they live. If of a nervous, sanguineous temperament, they are abolitionists. Then interests were never persuaded. Can you convince the shoe interest, or the iron interest, or the cotton interest, by reading passages from Milton or Montesquieu? You wish to satisfy people that slavery is bad economy. Why, Edinburgh Review pounded on that string and made out its case 40 years ago. A Democratic statesman said to me long since that, if he owned the state of Kentucky, he would manumit all the slaves and be a gainer by that transaction. Is this new? No, everybody knows it. As a general economy, it is admitted. But there is no one owner of the state, but a good many small owners. One man owns land and slaves. Another owns slaves only. Here is a woman who has no property, like a lady in Charleston I knew of who owned 15 chimney sweeps and rode in her carriage. It is clearly a vast inconvenience to each of these to make any change. And they are fretful and talkative, and all their friends are. Those less interested are inert, and from want of thought, averse to innovation. It is like free trade, certainly in the interest of nations, but by no means the interest of certain towns and districts, which tariff feeds fat. And the eager interest of a few overpowers the apathetic general conviction of the many. Banknotes rob the public, but are such a daily convenience that we silence our scruples and make believe they are gold. So imposts are the cheap and right taxations. But by the dislike of people to pay out a direct tax, governments are forced to render life costly by making them pay twice as much, hidden in the price of tea and sugar. In this national crisis, it is not argument that we want, but that rare courage which dares commit itself to a principle, believing that nature is its ally and will create the instruments it requires, and more than make good any petty and injurious profit which it may disturb. There was never such a combination as this of ours, and the rules to meet it are not set down in any history. We want men of original perception and original action who can open their eyes wider than to a nationality, namely, to considerations of benefit to the human race, can act in the interest of civilization. Government must not be a parish clerk, a justice of the peace. It has, of necessity, in any crisis of the state, the absolute powers of a dictator. The existing administration is entitled to the utmost candor. It is to be thanked for its angelic virtue, compared with any executive experiences with which we have been familiar. But the times will not allow us to indulge in compliment. I wish I saw in the people that inspiration which, if government would not obey the same, it would leave the government behind and create on the moment the means and executors it wanted. Better the war should more dangerously threaten us, should threaten fracture in what is still whole, and punish us with burned capitals and slaughtered regiments, and so exasperate the people to energy, exasperate our nationality. There are scriptures written invisibly on men's hearts, whose letters do not come out until they are enraged. They can be read by war fires, and by the eyes in the last peril. Well, as you're hearing, Mr. Emerson has a lot to say, and I thought I was going to be able to read his article in two sessions, but I'm already 20 minutes in, and I still have quite a ways to go. So I'm going to stop and read the conclusion in a third section next week. So this is the end of American Civilization for today. After our rather heavy reading of Mr. Ralph Waldo Emerson, we will go to a little bit lighter topic with our second article today. The most important ingredient in chewing gum. This was written by Hannah Seo. At the turn of the 20th century, William Wrigley Jr. was bent on building an empire of gum, and as part of his extensive hustle, he managed to persuade the U.S. Department of War to include his products in soldiers' rations. His argument, baseless at the time, was that chewing gum had miraculous abilities to quench thirst, stave off hunger, and dissipate nervous tension. But he was right. Scientists have since found that gum chewing can indeed increase concentration, reduce the impulse to snack, alleviate thirst, and improve oral health. Perhaps that's why people around the world have had the impulse to gnaw on tacky materials. Roots, resins, twigs, blubber, tar made by burning birch bark for at least 8,000 years. Today, gum is again being marketed as a panacea for wellness. You can buy gum designed to deliver energy, nutrition, stress relief, or joint health. Scientists are even developing gums that can protect against influenza, herpes, and COVID. Ironically, this new era of chewing gum is manufactured with a distinctly modern ingredient, one not associated with wellness: plastic. By the time Wrigley began his business venture, Americans had grown accustomed to chewing gum sold as candy-coated balls or packaged sticks. The base of these chewing gums was made from natural substances such as spruce resin and chicle, a natural latex that Aztecs and Mayans chewed for hundreds, if not thousands, of years. Unfortunately for 20th century Americans, the Chico Zapote trees that exude chicle take a long time to grow, and if they're overtapped, they die. Plus, cultivated trees don't produce nearly as much chicle as wild trees, says Jennifer Matthews, an anthropology professor at Trinity University and the author of Chicle. In the 1950s, chicle harvesters began struggling to meet demand, so gum companies turned to the newest innovations in material science, synthetic rubbers and plastics. Today, most companies' gum base is a proprietary blend of synthetic and natural ingredients. If a packet lists gum base as an ingredient, that gum most likely contains synthetic polymers. The FDA allows gum base to contain any of dozens of approved food-grade materials, substances deemed either safe for human consumption or safe to be in contact with food. Many, though, are not substances that people would otherwise think to put in their mouth. These include polyethylene, the most common type of plastic used in plastic bags and milk jugs, polyvinyl acetate, a plastic also found in glue, and styrene butadiene rubber, which is commonly used in car tires. The typical gum base contains 2 to 4 types of synthetic plastics or rubbers, Gwendolyn Graff, a confectionery consultant, told me. Everything we love about gum today is thanks to synthetic polymers, Graff said. Polyvinyl acetate, for example, strengthens the bubble film. If you blow a bubble and it starts to get holes in it and deflate, That's usually an indicator that it doesn't have polyvinyl acetate, Graf said. Styrene butadiene rubber creates a bouncy chewiness that makes gum more likely to stick to itself rather than to the surfaces, to surfaces like your teeth. Polyethylene can be used to soften gum so that it doesn't tire out your jaw. Gums with only natural polymers can feel like you're going to fall apart. They're going to fall apart in your mouth, Graf said. Plastic gum, though, also falls apart in a way. Gum chewing has been linked to microplastic ingestion. In a study published in December, UK researchers had a volunteer chew on a piece of gum for an hour, spitting into test tubes as they went. After an hour of gum chewing, the saliva collected contained more than 250,000 pieces of micro and nanoplastics, comparable to the level that microplastics found in a liter of bottled water. In a study presented at a recent meeting of the American Chemical Society, which has not yet been peer-reviewed, a graduate student's saliva contained elevated microplastic levels after she chewed gum. She chewed several commercially available gums, including natural ones. The research on gum chewing and microplastics is still limited. These two papers effectively represent analysis of just two people's post-chew saliva. But gum chewing has also been correlated to higher urine levels of phthalates, plastic softening chemicals that are known endocrine disruptors. Scientists are still learning about the health impacts of microplastic ingestion, too. Microplastics find their way into all kinds of foods, from packaging or contamination during manufacturing, or because the plants and animals we eat absorb and ingest microplastics themselves. As a result, microplastics have been found in human livers, kidneys, brains, lungs, intestines, placentas, and breast milk. But exactly how our bodies absorb, disperse, and excrete ingested plastic is not very well studied, says Marcus Garcia, who researches the health effects of environmental contaminants at the University of New Mexico. But scientists are still trying to understand whether or how microplastics cause disease. The answer could affect the future of what we choose to eat or chew. Ingesting tiny plastic particles might seem inevitable, but over the past 10 years or so, Americans have grown understandably fearful about bits of plastic making their way into our food. For anyone worried about swallowing still more plastic, after all, gum is easy enough to avoid. We are out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.